You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
This is an interview I was really looking forward to. This is a guy who's doing really important stuff in New Orleans. He's Richard Campanella. He's a geographer at Tulane. He's written many books and many articles centering around geography, but he has more than the, a wider style. In fact, I was just reading the reviews from one of his books. This is a book he did about Bourbon Street. And the New York Book of Reviews, I think, capitalizes it well. It says, Campanella writes in straightforward, unadorned style, combining a historian's scrupulousness, a sociologist's attention to sources, and a geographer's fascination with the influence of terrestrial conditions and culture and politics and development. And so it kind of just talks about the different areas that you look at. And so it gives you highly informative and highly readable products. So thank you for doing that. It's a good contribution to New Orleans. Your latest book, the one that's on the stands now, is called Draining New Orleans, which is a hell of a topic. Draining New Orleans, a 300-year quest to dewater the Crescent City. First of all, I've never heard the word dewater before. Is that something that the geographers use?
Yeah, it's in circulation, and it's useful because it's self-defining. And it's applicable to many fields. There's dewatering in medicine, there's dewatering in engineering. And here it means the reclamation of the back swamp, that is the removal of the standing water, and then the lowering of the groundwater, which comes with subsurface drainage.
Well, I hope to show my hand. I hope to get you into a future show to talk in detail about this book, because there is so much to talk about. But let me ask you one thing. Is this just an urban tale, or is it true that the city of The Hague studied the New Orleans water drainage system because they had those same sort of problems, and that their system is patterned after ours?
Yeah. Well, the contact there is Albert Baldwin Wood consulted for the Netherlands, and a lot of his technology and his patents for the pumps have been exported to the Netherlands as well as Egypt and China.
All right. And so have you been to The Hague?
I've been to Rotterdam a couple of times and have interacted with a lot of the Dutch engineers in that process that I characterize in the very last chapter of the book, Dutch Dialogues. And I should note that last chapter is titled Rewatering New Orleans.
Right. But could you see the New Orleans influence there?
I would not say that. I would say actually the reverse. I would say that in the past couple of years, we're seeing influences from the Netherlands here.
Okay. Well, it's a typical New Orleans thing. Okay, New Orleans, we want to be the one that influences the other people rather than the other people being the one that influences us, you know.
But I guess, well, you know what? The Netherlands has had a 500 to 1,000 year head start.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I got to give them a little bit of credit. Speaking of geography, and you've had many books, but you had a book about Bourbon Street and about the New Orleans landscape and about the West Bank. You also do articles in the certainly in The Advocate, no telling where else. I want to talk to you about some of those. Just one quick thing about the word geography. It just so happens that today I was doing something about the Jefferson Highway, which most New Orleanians think runs, from New Orleans to River Ridge. But the original Jefferson Highway, it ran between New Orleans and Winnipeg, Canada. And the thing I was reading is that they compared it, I think it was built in 1910, and in those days they didn't number the highways. And so this was really, it was a north-south highway. And they compared it to the Lincoln Highway, which was an east-west highway. And I was delighted when I read that, because that reminded me of my third grade geography book reading about the Lincoln Highway. Okay, I mean, that was one of the first things that was in there.
Yeah, well, you know, the terminus, there's a monument on St. Charles and Common Street,
right?
At the showing the terminus of it. I should also mention another one of these early auto highways has just celebrated its 100th anniversary, and that is the Old Spanish Trail.
And that ran from
it's basically like 190 coming across, you know, from Slidell through, you know, through Baton Rouge, and you know, it wasn't really the old Camino Real, yeah. But in that early age of auto tourism, a lot of these routes were given these interesting names in order to encourage tourism.
Right. And today, at least in the Louisiana area, most of what was Jefferson Highway would be known as Highway 71. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of winds its way up to the smart mm-hmm. country. It doesn't pass, you know, it's not like you're driving through Arizona and passing the Grand Canyon, you know. It doesn't have a lot of flat land between here and Winnipeg. You know, it passes through Des Moines in Kansas City and then winds up near Minneapolis. So I guess it'll still be a fascinating trip in its own way. But the and you also had a recent newspaper article. This was in the Advocate. It was about dairy farms.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I thought was so fascinating about that was that the, you know, what you pointed out, you know, if you're going to have a dairy farm, you got to have cows. And if you have a lot of cows, you're not going to have them in the city. You got to have them out in some kind of rural area. And so they had to be in the rural area. But anyway, what made that possible in terms of shipping back was the railroads, that the railroads really made dairy industry possible.
Yeah, this is a phenomena that I play upon quite often in my work, particularly with the West Bank, and it came up again with this article on what I call the dairy belt or the milk shed. And that the phenomena is this. I think of it as the close but not too close phenomena. Okay. And what that infers is that certain industries needed to be close enough to the metropolis for the market, but could not be too close to it because it raised real estate and production costs. Sure. And so what formed were these interesting annuluses, these rings of industrial activity or agricultural activity that needed to be close, but not too close. And I'll give you some examples. The West Bank was a perfect example of this. And that's why the West Bank had a lot more industry that we ever give our metropolis credit for. And one of the reasons was it was close enough to all the workers in the metropolis, they could take ferries over there, but it wasn't so close that it had high land values. And the fact that it didn't have a bridge until the 20th century kept those land values low. Here's another example. Think of all the fairgrounds and cemeteries that were laid out along the Metairie and Gentilly Ridge. They needed to be close enough to metropolis, but they couldn't be too close because they had a huge land footprint and it would have been too costly. So the dairy belt was another one of these spaces. And what activated it was that railroad built down from the Midwest, which had a policy of encouraging Midwesterners, many of them in the dairy industry, to settle in Tangipahoa Parish.
Hmm. And on the West Bank, there's a railroad heritage. Like, wasn't the city of West Wego, wasn't that,
yeah.
The name? Because that's where the...
It was
the ferry that put the trains on across the river.
Exactly, and that's why the Huey P is in that region, because the trains had previously used these big bulky transfer ferries to get across, and so the Huey P was originally sited there because it was originally exclusively a railroad bridge. Only later, and barely, the auto lanes were built. But one thing about the West Bank that is so obvious that sometimes we forget about it, it terrestrially connected to the rest, to the frontier, to the Western frontier. And so if cattle and resources from West Louisiana, Texas, and points west were coming into the metropolis and people were heading out of the metropolis to the Pacific Ocean, the West Bank was the good base to use, because you didn't have to make that awkward ferry connection across the Mississippi. And so the West Bank became, you know, we don't really think of New Orleans in the way we think of St. Louis and Omaha as being a jumping off point to the Western frontier, but the West Bank exactly was that. And I could show you some stories of cattle, Texas cattle being driven through the streets of Marrero that would make it sound like it was in Colorado. that's how much of a Western connection existed across the river. And Westwego is a perfect symbol of that, the very name.
Now, those cattle were ferried across the river?
Yeah, and there was a slaughterhouse in Algiers, but the main slaughterhouse was in Araby. And so they would have been ferried across the river and then processed there.
And then the name, the Whitney name, wasn't that a railroad name?
Yes, it was. Whitney, and that explains that neighborhood of Whitney in Algiers. And that's where the, you know, the Southern Pacific lines pulled in again for that Western access. And we, you know, the West Bank also had a heavy industrial component for those same reasons. They manufactured rolling stock. That locomotive that is still active, the very last steam locomotive that chugs around here, restored by these railroad aficionados, yeah, was manufactured in Algiers in 1920. And so when we always criticize ourselves for not having a manufacturing heritage, that criticism ought to be directed at the East Bank, not at the West Bank.
Yeah. And, you know, just as an aside, a real overlooked gem, New Orleans is lucky, and actually it's better than it actually deserves, for the passenger rail service it has. We have three lines that go out of here, and one of them is Sunset Limited. I don't know if you've ever ridden Sunset Limited, but when it leaves New Orleans heading west, that crossing over the Mississippi is one of the great crossings in all of railroading. And I think from the point where the ascent starts to the point where the descent ends on the other side is like one of the longest rail crossings in the world. But when
the reason is when the Huey P. was built in 1935, freight trains could only muster a 1.25% grade incline. And so that necessarily meant it had to be a very long and gradual bridge.
Well, it's when it's at the top, when it's at its highest point, it's like you're in a 747 or something. I mean, you look around, you can almost see clouds on both sides. It's a great, great crossing. And I wish more people were aware of it than them, but I mean, it's really something to see.
My son, Jason, is he's 10 years old, and he's a train buff, model railroader. And when we go over the Huey P. Long Bridge, we all have to fall silent. So
good
he
for you.
Absorb every minute of the locomotives coming over.
Yeah, see, that's the advantage of having a geographer for a dad. You'd know better, okay? Other dads would be taking pictures, and ordering coffee or something. So just really good. That eastbound train that used to be the Southern Crescent, when it goes across the Rigolets, it's sort of a nice moment,
too.
A train used to be known until its last days for having its own wood-burning stove, and they'd cook breakfast on the wood-burning stove, and so they'd be riding in the Crescent where they're cooking pancakes on the wooden stove.
If you look at some of these old cabooses, they have little, like, coal-burning hearths in them. You know, they were lodges.
Now, the city of New Orleans, wasn't it almost impossible to build a city where it is?
Well, let's have that conversation. it was the least lousy site within a superlative geographical situation. Okay. So, and by situation, I mean the broader realm, the lower Mississippi, connecting this incredibly vast hinterland that would eventually become the richest valley on earth, with this foreland that opened up to the Gulf of Mexico, the Caribbean, the Atlantic, and the rest of the world. So the
now that you put it that way, it sounds pretty damn good.
Well, it does sound pretty good with one problem. There were no specific sites, meaning the actual footing of the, you know, the physical footing of a potential city that were adequate. And so what Bienville did, leveraging off indigenous intelligence, the Iberville and Bienville learned so much from the natives, was that he was able to pinpoint the least lousy of a set of potential sites along the lower Mississippi within this fantastic larger situation.
Okay. And
I think of it as the least dirty shirt in the laundry.
Yeah. And so what made it so lousy was
fluvial delta. What made the lowermost 200 miles of the Mississippi so difficult for settlement is the fact that it's no longer in a valley. It emerges from a valley south of Baton Rouge. The Pleistocene terraces peter out, and where I'm looking down on right now over Howard Avenue used to be the open waters of the Gulf of Mexico. And starting about 7,000 or 8,000 years ago, waters from the Mississippi dumped out so much sediment at a pace faster than the sea could sweep it away that the river won the battle and formed a deltaic plain. But that by its very nature is dynamic and fluid and flood prone and soft, more so in some areas and less so in other areas. At the same time, it's ecologically fertile and it's replete with what I think of as opportunities for comings and goings, ingress and egress. You could get there from here. There were bayous and rivulets and inlets and outlets and distributaries and bays and rivers and lakes. And so for those reasons, it became very appealing to native occupation, and they called it Balbancha, land of many tongues, because there were so many tribes here. And so the colonials wanted a piece of this, a stick in this mud as well, for the same reasons. And I would credit Bienville with doing as good a job as any in finding a viable site.
Katrina reacquainted us with reality, you know, what we learned from Katrina, despite all the warnings. Do you feel that today, if we'd have a Katrina, everything equal to the previous Katrina, that we're much better off now in terms of protection?
Well, as long as you frame it in the relative sense, much better off, then I would concur. If you ask it in the sense of an absolute, are we safe? I would not say that. So I think everyone, even the fiercest critic, would agree that the $15 billion hurricane storm damage risk reduction system that we now have is much, much better than what we had the day before Katrina hit. Very few people would say that it's all we'll ever need. It was engineered for a 1% storm. It was not engineered for the 10,000 sort of year protection that the Netherlands is able to get, that being a different sort of delta. Katrina, by the way, was estimated to be a 1 in 396 year storm. Okay, so a 0.25%. So compare that to the 1% engineering behind our current system, and it falls short. That said, if we did have an exact replicate of Katrina, I think we could be assured that there would be much less damage, but there wouldn't be an absence of damage.
Okay. If somebody would come to New Orleans, I'm trying to ask, and be, let's say, roughly at the site of where Canal Street and Broad is, something like that, okay, and comparing it to the geography in the early days of the city, I know it'd be different, but how much different? Is that all swampland that they're?
Well, I'm glad you pinpointed it at Canal and Broad, because that gives me a lot of difference to point out. that was in the heart of the back swamp under natural conditions, and well into the early 1800s. And so by back swamp, I mean where the sediment deposition of the Mississippi river petered out. It was still above sea level, but it was low enough such that runoff, pluvial as well as fluvial, pluvial meaning rainwater, and then fluvial meaning overtopping of the Mississippi as well as infiltration through the soils from the Mississippi, would have impounded, and you would have had ankle deep or knee deep water most of the time. And the biogeography adapted to that. And that's why it would have been full canopy cypress forest. So what transformed over a spot like that over the long 19th century is essentially the topic of draining New Orleans. So the drainage of this city started out as purely gravitational for the first century because we didn't have any mechanized removal methods. That changed by the 1830s when we now had steam pumps. And so I described that first era as the ditch and gravity era, when we could only dig ditches and use gravity to get water off the surface. The next era I call the polder and paddle era, when we're able to break out these little hydrological subbasins and use these steam paddles to speed up and mobilize the natural drainage out Bayou St. John. And that was the main discharge. So to go back to your question, that broad and canal area would have been a little bit lower in its swamp water by the 1850s, 60s. And you could just imagine as the various tributaries of Bayou St. John would have had these awkward looking, almost like mountain gristmills, except instead of mountain water pushing the paddle, you'd have a steam engine pushing the paddle. And instead of grinding corn, you'd be pushing water. So this gets us to the 1890s, and that's the real focus of the book, when everything was in place, the civil engineering technology, the progressive era, civic spirit, and you really, that was critical, where well-educated locals were pushing city government to bring New Orleans into the modern age and improve its three major needs, which was potable water, sewage, and drainage. And out of this came the design of our modern day system and the 1899 founding of the Sewage and Water Board, and 3 years later, its merger with a pre-existing drainage commission, which gives the three charges of the Sewage and Water Board today. 10 years later, Albert Baldwin Wood invents and adds his wood screw pumps to the system. And the miracle of the 1910s was the near total disappearance of the New Orleans back swamps.
So Wood is really one of the real heroes of New Orleans, of the development of modern New Orleans.
Well, you know, heroes is a value judgment, because now in retrospect, we see the problems that have emerged with the dewatering and the swamps. And we also have come to understand the value that those swamps play. The term I use in the book, and by the way, Errol, it was the original title of the book, was Kings, the Drainage Kings. And that's what at least one of them, whose name, you can't make this up, his name was George Hero, and he was known as the Drainage King. Just about every strata of society, from wealthy to impoverished, white and black, free and enslaved, free people of color, almost, I would say 100% of the population agreed that the swamp was bad to the point of evil. And I literally mean they thought it was evil. They saw the source of miasmas, poisonous gases that needed to be eradicated. And so these so-called drainage kings were these engineers, and a lot of them coming out of the elite part of society in the pro bono publico spirit, to try to solve the problem of the back swamp. And eventually they succeeded all too well. And the paradox and the dilemma and the triumph turned tragic in the book is that once we dewatered these swamps and thought we could now never have to worry about topography and hydrology again, we settled with alacrity into these areas, created beautiful new subdivisions, and then started to realize they were subsiding deeply and quickly below sea level, becoming the low spots that the Betsy and Katrina flood would inundate.
Okay. I'm a delicate point here because I don't want to step too much on the information from your book. So if you could say, I can't answer that, that's fine, I understand. But this is such great information. How different would the Lake Pontchartrain shoreline have looked back then?
Well, what you have to do is look at the shoreline in Jefferson Parish and look at the shoreline in eastern New Orleans and connect them with a smooth line, okay? So that is to say that everything lakeside of Allen Toussaint and Leon C. Simon would have been in the lake. By that, I mean all those lake neighborhoods, Lake Terrace, Lake Oaks, Lake Vista, UNO campus, all of that was in Lake Pontchartrain up until this incredible engineering project from 1926 to 1934, in which a cofferdam was put out along what is now Lakeshore Drive. And all the water inside of that was removed. A sediment was excavated lakeside of the cofferdam, turned into a slurry, pumped into the cofferdam, drained, repumped, until land 5 feet above sea level was created there. So that whole swath that now bumps out from the lake is, 90 years old now? And it was created not just to create new valuable scenic new land, but to protect the sinking neighborhoods behind it, today's Lakeview and Gentilly.
You know, this reminds me, I was once in Boston, and I was staying at the Back Bay Hilton. And when I got to my room, the first thing I did, I went to the back room because I wanted to see what the Back Bay looked like. And I was envisioning oyster luggers and pirate ships and who knows, whatever else. All it was just more town, more buildings.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of that is reclaimed land.
Yeah. So I asked somebody, I said, well, where's the Back Bay? There is no Back Bay, okay? I mean, it's just all refilled.
Yeah.
And then that same trip, went a tour, and I was curious where the site was, where the Boston Tea Party was, where in the bay. And so I asked them, where was the boat for the Boston Tea Party? Says, see that bank? Where that bank is, that's where the Boston Tea Party was.
Yeah.
So it's like none of that exists anymore.
Yeah. Well, you know, the corollary to that here is when Bienville first started work on New Orleans in March, April of 1718, it was, by my best estimate, around the 400 to 600 block of Decatur North Peters. The river was just a couple dozen feet away. Now it's like 800 feet away. And the same thing in the CBD. The river was right almost up to Chapatula Street. Now it's like 900 feet away.
And it didn't have a levee. I guess it had a little bit of a natural levee.
It had the crest of the natural levee. But what happened was that in the early 1800s, the river started to dramatically shift, scour into the west bank, run slack on the east bank, and by running its slack, it lost its kinetic energy and dumped out all the sand, and a batcher started to form on the east bank. And so the city eagerly moved out the artificial levee to capture that batcher, and that batcher became a very famous and complicated legal case. It was known as the St. Mary Batcher, and eventually that gave rise to today's warehouse district.
And that was part of that was all part of the Batcher. Okay.
That was all part of the Batcher, and it was in the river when the city was founded.
Yeah. Let me think about one more tributary, and that's Bayou St. John. I look at it, sometimes I feel sorry for it. I said, this poor bayou, it looks like it's a straitjacket. Okay. I mean, it's got these concrete walls on both sides, and at the end, at what was a long time ago the Mercy Hospital site, now it's just blighted. But it just kind of ends right there.
Yeah.
And to me, it's just kind of sad looking. I mean, I can imagine there was a time when it was a wonderful bayou with trees and swamps.
Bayou St. John cannot be overstated as to its hydrological importance to the city. That was the main discharge of the entire Uptown Basin. Really? There were tributaries, there were bayous coming through what is now the Carrollton, Audubon Park, Tulane, Loyola area. There was another tributary coming from the Lower Garden District, and there were other ones over to the east. And they all flowed into Bayou St. John, and that is how rainwater naturally got out of the city. So over time, we've cut off and drained and filled in those tributaries. And in the 1930s, Bayou St. John was completely emptied out. Its banks were hardened, and it was dammed off of the river. However, I would say in the last 10 years, dammed off from the lake, Lake Pontchartrain, that connection to Lake Pontchartrain has been partially reopened. And so now there's actually some movement of brackish lake water and the various biota related to it back and forth into Bayou St. John. And that has made it ecologically much healthier. And recreationally, it's better used now than I've ever seen before. There are kayakers and canoeists and those, standing surfboards. And then you have the festival there. So, I would say it's actually a really vibrant area compared to decades past.
So the water runs from the lake into the city now.
Yes, there is some flow from City Park, some rainwater flow there. Yeah. And then there's some movement from the lake, but it's no longer a catchment, okay? It's been severed off from all of its former watershed, which used to go from Carrollton all the way to Esplanade Avenue.
I've seen a map of the water system of City Park, and it's amazing what's beneath the ground there. I mean,
yeah, it's intricate. Yeah,
I mean, it's like Venice. People see golf courses and different kind of ground, but below the surface, there's a lot going on behind there, and pumps and all that moving that water back and forth. And yeah. Actually, part of it drains Lakeview. Yeah. I mean, part of Lakeview drains beneath City Park, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Well, ask you just quickly about Bourbon Street, because I know that was one of your books. What fascinates you most about Bourbon Street?
Well, once again, it is the geographical question, because the single unifying aspect of just about every one of my books and my articles is the spatial component. That's what makes me a geographer. I look in the historical dimension. I analyze how people settle in place, and I certainly look at the underlying landscape, the geology of it. But what unifies all of it is the concept of spatial explanation. So I try to understand why things, phenomena arose where they are. Okay. So it's the questions of where and wherefore, where and why there. And what's fascinating about Bourbon Street is like if someone came down from Mars and saw this city here and saw this incredible bustling activity 365 days a year, every single night, a question might arise, why the hell there? Why is that? How did that certain 5,000 foot long stretch become home to this sort of concentrated activity to a degree that people either love it or hate it citywide, statewide, nationwide, and worldwide? And when you frame it that way, it becomes a very provocative question. And that was my guidepost in writing that book. Put all judgment aside. Yes, yes, I know. We all hate Bourbon Street. Yes, yes, I know. It's inauthentic. Put all that aside and look at it as a genuine artifact of this city. And so a lot of that book, I try to answer the question and solve the mystery of why that particular place, which, by the way, for the first half of the city's history, was just another downtown street, how it became loved and hated worldwide.
And was it always known as Bourbon Street?
It was always known as Bourbon Street from the very day that Adrian de Poget first surveyed it and named it. And no, it has nothing to do with the drink. It's pure serendipity.
Well, then you've kind of teased us here. What was it that all of a sudden made it so popular?
No, you have to read the book.
Okay, all right. we will assume it wasn't the strip clubs, that there was something else about it that did it, and certainly the proximity to it. Yeah, you know, the thing about the Bourbon Street, like, you're right, a lot of people kind of hate it. A lot of times you kind of feel disappointed by it. And, you know, walking in the quarter, sometimes I feel that. And then sometimes you smell mayonnaise and you smell coffee, and then you see the smokestacks from a ship going down the river, and then you hear music come somewhere. And sometimes it seems like the most special place on earth, okay? And then other times it just seems like trash. And so kind of, I wish you could.
Well, I find it very intellectually liberating to refrain from personal judgment and look at phenomena like this phenomenologically. That is to say, to ponder the question of why is this happening in this location? Here's another thing I will say about this notion of authenticity and what's real and what's fake, and this constant sense that we seem to feel the need to pass judgment and determine if it's really the true New Orleans or not. And that is perceptions of inauthenticity with the passage of time become authentic. 100 years ago, intellectuals and sophisticated people in the literary set and the cognoscenti turned up their nose and sneered at Storyville. Okay. And they saw it as repugnant and morally repugnant and not representative of New Orleans and a terrible message that was being sent to the rest of the nation about the city. Now you can't turn around with another scholarly academic PhD thesis being written about Storyville. And what happened in the century since? And we look back on it and we reconsidered it, and we now view it as being much more authentic and part of the legitimate New Orleans story. And I bet 100 years from now, whatever the state of the city might be, academics and intellectuals and scholars will look back on the Bourbon Street of the early 2000s and view it with as much intellectual curiosity as they now have for Storyville.
Well, at least there's always Galatoire's. You know, so
there you go. There you go.
What I say about the French Quarter is that it's not what it used to be, but it never has been what it used to be. I mean, it's not like Williamsburg. I mean, it's not a place that's put in a straitjacket and they have to be this way. I mean, it's an old neighborhood, but it's still a living neighborhood. And with that, subject to change.
There's no such thing as inauthentic.
Okay. Well, that's probably a good message to close with. Let me ask you again about your book, your Draining New Orleans. It's really a good book. It's really an important book. Well written.
I would like to say that my publisher for the past 10 years has been LSU Press, including for this one. They're great to work with. I'm happy to be with them. And they put out great books.
They are really on a roll, because over here we get a lot of their books. They're doing some really good stuff over there.
I completely agree.
You know, sometimes some university press things, you see, it's not so good. You know, it's like, the interns are doing it, but LSU Press is doing some really really good work. And so this is available on all places where you find good books, right? I mean, all the websites and all the bookstores, what there are of them. So Draining New Orleans on the 300-year quest to the water, the Crescent City. What's your next book?
Right now, I am working on a statewide project, which is new for me. Not at least for the past 20 or 30 years. And I am learning so much. And what it is a study explaining the spatial locations of every Louisiana village, town, and city. That is, once again, this fundamental geographical question of why did those communities arise at those sites? That is the inquiry. I'm trying to figure out the initial citing reason of why Alexandria and Monroe and Abita Springs and Lake Charles and every other large and small community arose at that particular location.
Hmm. We had on this podcast the mayor of Monroe recently, and that's a part of the state we don't talk about that much, but they got all kinds of things going on, and they're envisioning some sort of a link between Monroe and Alexandria and Baton Rouge. It's like a triangle sort of thing, an economic development thing, one that I think primarily between technology and agriculture, but also tourism. I wouldn't think tourism, but they got those prehistoric things over there, and they got that.
Yeah, that's been a popular regional development strategy ever since the incredible success of Research Triangle in North Carolina. There's also kind of, I think they call it the Golden Triangle in northeastern Mississippi, West Point, Tupelo, and Corinth. And so, yeah, I could imagine that. It seems a little bit expansive. I mean, Monroe, Alexandria, and Baton Rouge are not exactly, tight enough to form a triangle, but I wish them the best. And it's an interesting geographical strategy.
I think it might be a little bit better with Monroe, Alexandria, in Vicksburg. If you cross the river, at least it's a little bit more triangle-ish, I think.
Well, the great advantage of Vicksburg, Monroe, and Shreveport is the I-20 corridor there.
Yeah,
that's the interstates are to the late, to the 21st century what the railroads were to the 20th, and what rivers were to the 19th.
Well, to bring this conversation full circle, they're also talking about railroads, because apparently there are plans to have a link, Amtrak, to develop, and maybe already exists a link between Dallas and Atlanta, and somehow linking onto that link, with having service into Monroe and I guess cities along the way too. And they're talking seriously about it. I mean, whenever people talk about railroads, I'm kind of like, yeah, sure. But they're talking about, they're naming the year, in 2024 that they're looking for it. So best of luck with
all
that.
Well, to link this back to this siting study that I'm working on, the number one vector for settlements to arise in the late 19th century was railroads.
Yeah.
And it happened for their need for mail stops, flag stops, stations, and depots. And wherever one of these stations opened, it increased the economic value of that spot, and thus rose places like Ponchatoula and Amite City. Slidell is a railroad town.
If I may, just let me mention one more, because I love these topics, But in my research about Mardi Gras, no one who's written about Carnival and Carnival's origins has ever thought about the railroads as being a factor. But they were a major factor. I think it was in 1868 that the first nationwide railroad was completed, or at least that
1869,
all right. Rex started in 1872. And one thing they did, there was stories about the railroads putting up these brochures at all their train stations, come to New Orleans to see the Mardi Gras. And so I think the growth of the passenger railroads really kind of triggered the impulse for economic development using Mardi Gras. And certainly Rex was doing that in 1872, because 1872, the railroads were new, they were exciting. And so this was something that they were starting to tap. So I think that was the main factor.
What railroads did by the late 19th century is they made travel not only swift but luxurious, and they worked hand in hand, the railroad companies, with hotels. And that's where the city that Care Forgot got coined. It was a marketing slogan of a hotel working with a railroad to increase tourism. Another motto you saw in the early 1900s, again, hotels working with railroads, was New Orleans, America's wintertime capital. And what's in the middle of winter? It's Mardi Gras. So yeah, absolutely.
So that was the railroads that do that. Okay. Amazing. And it kind of reminds me of what the railroads did for the national parks. It was
exactly.
There were real impetus for the national parks and putting up the lodges and doing a lot of the
promotion. Right. And it coincided with a time when industry had brought in new wealth, created a new educated middle class that had the discretionary income and the interest to go see their nation.
And, as far as I'm going to go with this, on a lesser level, it kind of reminds me of what the streetcars did, the streetcar lines did to promote ridership to West End, where you had the, what was it called, the recreation area down by the lakefront. And but with the railroads, I mean, they had the West End streetcar that, you know, that ran. I think they did a lot of that same sort of thing, you know, take the streetcar to the lakefront. So,
right.
Anyway, we can go on and on with this. Sorry. Thank you very much. It's been delightful.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, let's do it again. I'd love to go into the draining book in more details next time. So,
all righty.
But everybody go out and read it, okay? And then when you finish reading it, we'll do this again. Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.